for it says in the papers again from Deirdre Purcell.
Michael Clifford's lead story for the Irish Examiner this morning tells us that a Garda informer has received a six-figure sum in state compensation because Garda and DPP statements about his identity and role were revealed to a three-man gang. The paper's front page also runs a story you heard in the business news that the Society of St Vincent de Paul has urged the central bank to reveal the true depth of Ireland's money lending crisis following what it says is the alarming rise in the numbers of poverty-stricken families who are taking loans they have no hope of paying. The main story for the Irish Independent is that grocery prices here have increased by 5%. That's 10 times the inflation rate. Also on the Independent's front page, we're told that during his time as junior minister at the Department of Enterprise, TD John McGuinness, chairman of the Doyle's Public Accounts Committee, argued that his wife should accompany him on trips to Dubai and Canada. And there'll be more on this story later in this programme. The Irish Times lead story by Harry McGee tells us that the government has admitted its performance on key Doyle reform measures has been deplorable. Meanwhile, the paper's religious affairs correspondent, Patsy McGarry, gets front page space to tell us that the Catholic bishops are to intensify pressure on the government this week, as in a joint statement they express outright opposition to the proposed Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill. And in that context, the Independent tells us that the Fine Gael TD, Peter Matthews, has said he will vote against the bill. The Times tells us that there is now a dispute over the route of the new walk and cycleway proposed to run from Sutton to Sandycove, because part of the route could be diverted away from the seafront to preserve bird habitats. Today's main editorial in The Times concerns a central bank paper on property matters. It makes suggestions about how to avoid a property bubble in future. One suggestion is that homeowners become subject to capital gains tax on the sale of their homes. There's an interesting green shoot piece on page 3 of that paper, wherein we're told that architects, who've not had such great times recently, are becoming more optimistic about the future, according to a recent survey. Pictures everywhere of our boxing team, including our gold and silver medalists, with Jonjo Nevin holding his Best Boxer of the Tournament award. An editorial in the Irish Daily Mail welcomes a government initiative which would involve a new category of taxi, licensed to operate in remote rural areas to alleviate the isolation of residents hit by closures of pubs, post offices, Garda stations and local shops. The Health and Living section of The Independent gives us a feature on hemochromatosis, the hereditary illness dubbed the Celtic curse, because one in 83 people in this country suffers from it, and one in 5 of us carries the gene. The favoured site for a sewage superplant in North Dublin will be revealed later today. In the running, according to many of the papers, are two locations near Lusk and one in Clonchoc, about 2 kilometres from Dublin Airport. More than 10,000 objections from residents have been lodged against the plant. The Examiner and Independent both tell us that developer Sean Dunn, who has told bankruptcy proceedings in the US that he has only $976 to his name in his bank account, managed to make the 2,600-kilometre journey from Connecticut to Houston, Texas, to see Ireland's rugby team in action against a US side. And finally, in The Times, columnist Maureen Dowd is weighing in on that covert and worldwide cyber-snooping issue revealed in the Guardian and Washington Post newspapers, as a result of which we now know that none of our private communication is private. She tells us, however, it was quaint to think we had any privacy left once Google, Facebook, Twitter and Instagram braided themselves into our lives.
Last week, we learned that US security agencies have been gathering millions of phone records and tapping into the personal data of many of the world's biggest internet companies. This week, we know the man behind the revelation. He's 29-year-old Edward Snowden, describes himself as an ex-CIA technical assistant, says people have a right to know that their every action on the internet, emails, Skype, searches and more, are being watched and collected by security agencies, and knows the consequences for him will be serious.
Any analyst at any time can target anyone, any selector anywhere, Where those communications will be picked up depends on the range of the sensor networks and the authorities that that analyst is empowered with. Not all analysts have the ability to target everything, but I, sitting at my desk, certainly had the authorities to wiretap anyone, from you or your accountant to a federal judge to even the president if I had a personal email.
One of the extraordinary parts about this episode is that usually whistleblowers do what they do anonymously and take steps to remain anonymous for as long as they can, which they hope often is forever. You, on the other hand, have decided to do the opposite, which is to declare yourself openly as the person behind these disclosures. Why did you choose to do that?
I think that the public is owed an explanation of the motivations behind the people who make these disclosures that are outside of the democratic model. When you are subverting the power of government, that's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy. And if you do that in secret consistently, you know, as the government does when it wants to benefit from a secret action that it took, it'll kind of give its officials a mandate to go, hey, you know, tell the press about this thing and that thing, so the public is on our side. But they rarely, if ever, do that when an abuse occurs. That falls to individual citizens, but they're typically maligned. You know, it becomes a thing of these people are against the country, they're against the government. But I'm not. I'm no different from anybody else. I don't have special skills. I'm just another guy who sits there day to day in the office, watches what's happening, and goes, this is something that's not our place to decide. The public needs to decide whether these programs and policies are right or wrong. And I'm willing to go on the record to defend the authenticity of them and say, I didn't change these. I didn't modify the story. This is the truth. This is what's happening. You should decide whether we need to be doing this.
That's Edward Snowden speaking to the Guardian newspaper from Hong Kong, where he's hiding out at the moment. While many of the companies involved in PRISM, the tracking of data by US security agencies, have bases here in Ireland. The Data Protection Commissioner here is Billy Hawkes. He's with me now in our studio. Billy Hawkes, thank you very much for coming in to us. Did you know that data generated here was being treated like this?
I don't think it'll come as much of a surprise that, in fact, US intelligence services do have access to information from US companies. In the case of companies that have data centers here, like Microsoft and Google, these are American companies, obviously subject to US law. They have data centers in different parts of the world. They happen to have centers also here in Ireland. So I'm not sure it'll come as a great surprise to anybody that in the rather murky world of intelligence, there is significant power to access information for intelligence purposes.
But did you know they were doing this?
I knew in a general way. I don't regard this particular revelation as particularly new. I think I'd have known as a matter of general knowledge, as would people in general, that intelligence services have extensive access and rights of access, indeed, to information. Indeed, under our own Irish law and European law, our own Gardaí have significant rights of access to information, again, subject to safeguards. And I think the key point that was being made by the whistleblower are these safeguards adequate in this area? In other words, if you accept that there is a justification for access to this information for anti-terrorism purposes primarily, then the argument is, are the oversight systems sufficient to balance up the significant interference with people's rights?
Well, what about for people who are nervous about this, who feel that you say that they might have had a suspicion that whatever they did on the internet was being tracked, but that everything they do is being monitored, and everything they do was being gathered in this manner in massive data centers in Utah, in Texas, and in Georgia. Is none of our information online private? Do you not have any obligations to, I mean, the description of your job, Data Protection Commissioner, is none of our data protected?
No, I think it is, obviously, and I think we're talking here about intelligence services targeting particular individuals for good reasons.
But it seems to be more blanket than that, judging from the revelations in The Guardian and The Washington Post last week, that it's all information.
No, and I think that is where the concern would be. The concern might be that it would be of abuse of a power that was given for a legitimate reason, in other words, to try and identify people who might be engaged in terrorist activities. Naturally, I would be concerned about this, but as I said, the type of exercise here goes beyond what data protection law is designed for, which is essentially is the normal world, which is not the world of intelligence and security, is designed to protect people against, if you like, day-to-day activity to make sure that your bank or your supermarket doesn't leak information about you and that you can be reasonably secure that your information is okay there.
Okay, well, take Google and Microsoft, who've just built very large data centres here in Dublin. Is it credible that the traffic that's being captured is not going through this PRISM process as we've heard about over the last week or so?
No, on the contrary, I would expect that data held in data centres in Ireland or indeed anywhere else, because these companies typically have centres in different parts of the world and you won't know at any moment where the data is in these centres. I think it's nothing particularly new that there would be access by intelligence services to this data if it was required for legitimate reasons, that is things like searching out for terrorists. Because again, to be fair to the intelligence community, they get blamed when some terrorist act happens and says, why didn't you discover these people? Their argument is, how do you expect us to find a needle in a haystack? At least give us the power to access communications data.
Do you have any questions to ask of some of these large internet companies based in Ireland on the basis of what you've heard over the last week?
Well, what they have all denied that they voluntarily give out this information. They've been very clear that they only comply with legally enforceable instructions from law enforcement authorities. And certainly when we carried out an investigation of Facebook Ireland, which we have responsibility for in terms of users outside of North America, they were very clear, and we investigated that in fact they have very strict procedures for giving access to law enforcement. So what we seem to be talking about here in fact is something much broader, that perhaps they didn't even know this type of access was going on, because they have strict procedures themselves. But beyond that, we again, it is not new, certainly it isn't even new to me, that intelligence services have access to telecommunications information under rather vague permissions.
Billy Hawkes, Data Protection Commissioner here in Ireland, thank you very much for joining us in our studio this morning.
The chairman of the Dáil's Public Accounts Committee, John McGuinness, tried to bring his wife with him on official trips abroad when he was a junior minister. This is according to a report in the Irish Independent, which says he argued that the taxpayer should foot the bill for travelling ministers' spouses. John McGuinness is on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning, Colin.
To clarify, did you bring your wife with you on ministerial trips abroad, and did you or the state pay?
Not on trade missions. She did not travel, and that is the heart of this story.
Just to clarify, what other missions were there?
The St. Patrick's Day visits abroad.
And who paid for those?
Part and parcel.
And who paid for your wife on those trips?
The government paid for those.
All right.
On this particular issue, the question was asked by me if I could take my wife on a trade mission with me. It was my first trade mission. I was a newly appointed minister and I sought clarification on the matter. I was informed by the department that it was not the case that you could bring your wife, even though I had clearly expressed that I would pay for my wife and that no cost would be borne by the department. After I made that request, there was a considerable number of emails that passed between officials during the month of August in 2007, and when those were brought to my attention at the end of August, I decided I would address the general points that were being raised. I accepted a protocol, by the way, that even if I were to pay, my wife could not travel on a trade mission, but I had not been on a trade mission previously. I accepted that protocol, and I emphasise it was my intention, clearly from the very beginning, that I would pay for my wife's travel.
Now, you accepted that position at the end, but you did argue for the state paying for your wife accompanying you. Why would you regard that as a good idea?
I suggested that the 1959 circular, which the officials were basing their case on, was outdated. And that the regulation and protocol should be modernised.
Why?
Because there are circumstances, I'm sure, where ministers would like their spouses or partner to travel with them.
Why shouldn't they pay?
A case could be made and the minister should pay, but that there may be cases and circumstances where the state might pay.
Why?
And that is the case, for example, in relation to St. Patrick's Day and visits abroad. It continues on in this government.
Why should the state pay for somebody's spouse going on a St. Patrick's Day visit?
But they do.
Why?
It's part of government policy.
Why
because
should
there
they?
Are so, there are social events that take place, that the wife of the minister is expected to travel and attend. It happens now, as it happened in every other St. Patrick's Day down through the years.
Can we afford this? No.
I think that in the course of trade missions, you learn that you can't afford not to play a big part on the world stage in terms of our trade and economic development. Minister, the current minister, Eamon Gilmore, I'm sure would vouch for that. And it's essential for us, getting out of our economic difficulties that we're in, that Ireland will continue to be promoted in that way. But net point in relation to the discussion with the civil servants in this case was simply a clarification. But I was always, and it was made clear to them, intended to pay. And in my email to them in response in 2007, I said that it was always my intention to pay.
Just two matters arising, given I think that you've made it clear that your wife never travelled with you at the state's expense.
On trade missions,
although she did on St. Patrick's Day missions. The two matters arising are, first of all, going back to 2007 when you were a junior minister, and you wrote in one of these emails to your department, this is to one of your secretaries, or who had raised this, you would be able to establish that it was always my intention to pay for my wife, although I believe there is a strong case to be made for the state paying, despite the costs which such a position would generally create across departments. What strong case is there for bringing your spouse with you on a trade mission?
As I said to you, in terms of trade missions, the protocol is that the wife does not travel. But there are circumstances that should be considered when ministers are away on state business for long periods of time, and where they believe that their wife should travel, and they should pay, and there may be other circumstances where the minister can then make a case within a new set of guidelines where he believes the state should pay.
Why?
Because work, in my opinion, work practices have certainly changed. Family are now central to everything, and it may be that a minister might want to make that case around his wife or spouse and around his family.
I can understand why it would be desirable to have your wife or your husband with you. What I'm trying to get at is why you believe the state should pay in some circumstances.
Well, that would be a matter for the minister who's making the case.
Well, you did make the case, so can you tell us why you believed, as a junior minister in 2007, that there was a strong case for the state paying for your wife going on the trip?
Well, can I just be clear about this, Gal, that as far as I'm concerned, in 2007, on the trade missions, I suggested that I would pay for my wife.
I'll quote it one more time. I believe there is a strong case to be made for the state paying, despite the costs which such a position would generally create across departments. Now, you are now the chairman of the Public Accounts Committee. What public accounts reason would there be as a minister for the case that you argued? You said in that email there was a strong case. What we'd like to know is what is that case?
There may very well be that a minister could make a case on family grounds, on health grounds, on business grounds for the state abroad, on the length of time he's away doing business for the state abroad, on simply having the company of his wife or spouse as he does his business abroad. And I think that that's a matter then for the state to consider.
All right.
My point in this is that the 1959 regulation needs to be updated and modernised to reflect the modern family and family supports that are required in the context of a businessman or a minister doing business while being away from his family for a long period of time.
Okay, and the state paying.
Now,
could just come on to your current responsibilities, Chairman of the Public Accounts Committee. Whatever about modern family responsibilities, there are modern financial realities. Can we afford, do you believe we can afford to pay in some circumstances for a minister's spouse to go along on a trip abroad? I'm asking, do you believe we can afford it?
Well, can we afford not to do it in terms of trade missions and in terms of our promotion of Ireland abroad, for example, on St. Patrick's Day? I don't believe that we can ignore it. And I don't believe that we can ignore the role of a family and a spouse in the work that is being undertaken by a senior minister in relation to his work as a minister on behalf of the state.
John McGuinness.
And I think that it has to be observed that in most cases, right across different government departments, they travel with their spouse in order to promote Ireland and to ensure that we play that role in rebuilding our economy.
All right, John McGuinness.
But it was always my intention to pay for my wife.
All right, John McGuinness, Chairman of the Public Accounts Committee, thank you for talking to us. Welcome back. You're listening to Morning Ireland at just after 24 minutes to nine, and it's time for the sport. It's Darren Frahill.
Yes, a very good morning, Cathal, and we'll start, of course, with the first of our draws for Championship 2013. Really hard to believe it's that time of year again. The first of this year's draws takes place here in the Morning Ireland studio. Yes, it's the preliminary phase and phase one hurling draws, and joining me here in studio for the double draw is former Wexford hurler and All-Ireland winner in 1996, Tom Dempsey. Tom, a very good morning to you.
Thanks, Darren.
In a moment, those two draws, but first, let me talk you through all the details. In this morning's first draw, we have one bowl with seven teams. They are Antrim, Carlow, Westmeath, Offaly, who were beaten by Kilkenny yesterday, Wexford or Dublin, who drew on Saturday night, Waterford and London. Now, there are two parts to this morning's draw, and the first is the preliminary phase draw, where three games are drawn with the winners of each advancing to the first round proper. Now, it's important to note that the first team out each time has home advantage. The remaining team not drawn out in the preliminary round automatically advances to the phase one proper along with the winners of those three preliminary ties. Now, might sound complicated, but don't worry, I'll explain to you as we go along in full detail. We also have Fergal McGill, the GA operations manager, here just to oversee things and make sure everything goes to plan. Okay, let's get the first part of our draw underway and see which six teams will play in those three preliminary round matches as part of this year's Hurling Championship, which is of course sponsored by Centra, Etihad and Liberty Insurance. Tom, before we do this draw, can you please just give the bowl a good swirl, all those canisters a good swirl for me, please?
Get Wexford down to the bottom there, Darren.
Okay, here we go. The first one out.
Team 1, Darren, are Offaly.
So we have Offaly. They will have home advantage in this preliminary round draw. And travelling to Tullamore will be?
They will play Waterford.
Lovely stuff.
Tough draw.
Offaly, Waterford.
Team
a good
two,
one
Darren.
For the neutral.
Yeah. Team 2, Darren, are going to be Wexford or Dublin.
So Wexford or Dublin will have home advantage in this phase of the championship.
And they will play Antrim.
So Antrim will be staying in Leinster for their qualifier.
First team out.
And this is the final game now.
London.
So Ruislip will be the venue for the third and final game of the preliminary phase.
And they will play, Darren, Westmeath.
Westmeath, lovely stuff. Thanks, Tom. Now, we have one canister there in that bowl. We'll just leave it there for a moment. Let's just confirm those fixtures, first of all. And so the first team out of the bowl on each occasion will have home advantage, just to confirm that again. So we've Offaly against Waterford, Dublin or Wexford against Antrim, and London will have home advantage against Westmeath. And we have one team left in that bowl, and that is Carlow. And what we're going to do now is move. I should also confirm those three preliminary round matches will be played on Saturday, June 22nd. We're going to move on to the main draw of the morning. That's the phase one hurling draw. And again, we've one bowl, and in this team we'll have each of those fixtures. So the meeting of Offaly and Waterford will be fixture A, Dublin, Wexford or Antrim will be fixture B, and then London, Westmeath, that will be fixture C. And what I'm going to ask Tom to do is to put the one canister left, that's Carlow, into that draw drum. And can you give that a good twirl for me, please, Tom?
Of course, Darren.
So the first team out in this phase of the championship will be
Team B.
So that will be Dublin or Wexford up against Antrim. They'll have home advantage, the winner of those three.
And they will play Carlow.
So they have Carlow. Interesting one.
Next team out, Darren, is Team C.
So Team C, it'll be London or Westmeath. They'll have home advantage in the second and final Phase 1 qualifier.
And they will play Team A.
So it'll be Offaly or Waterford to travel over there. Now, it's important to just to point out as well that home advantage will be going to the following teams: Dublin, Wexford or Antrim against Carlow. And in the second match, London, Westmeath against Offaly or Waterford. Some fascinating matches there to look forward to. And of course, The winner of those two games then will advance to the phase three of the draw, and here will be joined by the beaten Leinster and Munster semi-finalists. So lots to look forward to. Tom, just to go through this very quickly, I suppose the standout fixture there in the preliminary round, we didn't expect this, Offaly against Waterford.
Yeah, I don't think either of them will thank me for that draw, really. The two heavyweights two of the heavyweights, I suppose, Wexford or Dublin, will be the third drawing each other. So that's going to be a really good game. We saw the atmosphere in Tullamore. Waterford will be favourites going in, Darren, but by God, Offaly gave Kilkenny a good welcome yesterday. So we're going to see a great game down there in Tullamore.
And obviously Dublin and Wexford will have their minds focused on this Saturday. We're going to get confirmation of that fixture and the venue hopefully later on today from the Leinster Council, but the winner of that has a nice draw, home win against Antrim. They'll fancy their chances.
Yeah, they will, and I have to say that the home draws, the provincial venues have done a great service to the GAA this year. It was fantastic in Wexford Park the other night, and you know, even London have got a home tie here, so you know, Westmeath,
I know Brian Hanley won't like taking Westmeath over there.
Well, you know, it's taking them out of their comfort zone, really, you know, and it's going to be a difficult one to go to London, and it'll be a great occasion in Ruislip as well.
Tom Dempsey, I know you're going to stay with us. That's the formalities over here, but we're going to be talking about yesterday's action just very shortly. So that's the draw. Details will be up on the Morning Ireland website and also on the RTE Sport website very shortly. Now, Limerick's hurlers are grabbing all the headlines in this morning's newspapers. They're through to the Munster final following a dramatic 118-115 victory over Tipperary. They'll meet either Clare or Cork in the Munster decider next month. In a moment, we'll hear from their manager, John Allen, a very happy man. But first, here's the moment that confirmed their first win in the province since 2007.
The Division 1B team have beaten the Munster champions. There will be new Munster champions in 2013. And Limerick celebrate here in the Gaelic grounds as if they have just won the Munster championship. A fantastic day for John Allen and for Limerick Hurling. And Allen takes the congratulations. He's been surrounded by Limerick Hurling fans, his management team. They all had a bit of a hug there. But Limerick have won by three and beaten Tipperary by 118-115. Gripping stuff.
I am absolutely very proud. I'm delighted because the players have put a huge amount into it, you know, and I know most managers would say their players are putting a huge amount in, and they are, there's no doubt about it, but these players have put just a phenomenal amount of work in, and I'm very happy for them. I'm just thrilled. You can see there by the reaction of the people that this is like an All-Ireland final or a Munster final or a semi-final, you know.
It really was incredible scenes down there. Tom Dempsey, can you put that victory into perspective, not only for Limerick but also for the Hurling Championship?
Well, I think it's blown Munster wide open now, and you know, every team left in at Cork, Clare will see a great chance to win a Munster Championship. The awakening of a sleeping giant, I suppose, in Limerick, and I think the whole country is delighted to see them come true. The Hurling Championship has been fantastic, particularly yesterday, and I think we've a lot to look forward to, Darren.
And just the other big hurling game yesterday, Tom, just a word on Kilkenny's victory over Offaly. Offaly started so well. The final score, though, ended in victory for Kilkenny, 26 points to 4-9. Not often you see a Kilkenny defence shift four goals like that.
Yeah, they never looked like losing the game in the second half, Darren, but I'll tell you, there are cracks there, and you know, four goals to concede, their full back line looked very uncomfortable when Jackie Turrell was gone out of it. So, you know, it's given everybody heart yesterday. If Limerick can beat Tip, maybe Kilkenny can be taken down in Leinster.
We'll wait and see. Tom Dempsey, thanks for joining us in studio this morning. In the Football Championship in Leinster, Wexford overcame Loud 213-115 in Drogheda, and in Ulster, Monaghan booked a place in the last four with an 11 points to 6 win against Antrim. Now the Irish under 20 sit top of Pool B at the IRB Junior World Cup following a 46-3 win against Fiji. They ran in 6 tries. Former Cork hurler Darren Sweetnam and Rory Scholes scored 2 apiece. Chris Taylor and Dan Levy were also on target. Mike Ruddock's side now level with the All Blacks in the standings ahead of their top of the pool clash on Thursday.
When we were given the pool and handed the pool, it was quite daunting but very exciting to play 3 Southern Hemisphere teams, go toe to toe with them, and particularly on the hard, firm grounds here in France. You know, so we didn't walk away from that challenge. In fact, we stepped up to the challenge, and I'm really proud of the players. They've put two big, big performances together and executed our game plans very well. And there's a lot of confidence in the squad now to take us into, you know, a fierce battle against New Zealand. And yeah, that's going to be the ultimate test for us, really, in the pool.
Looking forward to that. Well done to them. Shamrock Rovers recorded their first away win of the Airtricity League season thanks to a 2-1 win over Cork City yesterday. Rafael Nadal beat David Ferrer in straight sets to win the French Open. He's the first man to win a Grand Slam singles title 8 times. Finally, Sebastian Vettel took the honours at the Canadian Grand Prix in Montreal. He finished ahead of championship rival Fernando Alonso, while Lewis Hamilton took the final podium position.
Well, there are rural hackneys. It was part of the review of the taxi industry, which I conducted myself over a year ago, to look at the fact that there is market failure in rural Ireland. There simply isn't the public transport offering. There isn't the taxi offering in many isolated rural areas. And on your show on numerous occasions, you've talked about the issues of rural Ireland and rural isolation. So this is a measure that we're looking at to address this. It's to bring in a new form of rural hackney license with low entry costs that businesses or community groups could offer in communities to allow people to be able to be transported to various different events, to social occasions, etc. It is something we think is desperately needed, and in conjunction with a review of rural transport offering, which I'm currently conducting and which will be announced in the coming weeks, I think it's part of a package that could really help rural Ireland.
And now, I presume that if you're going to use a hackney to bring you home, it's going to be on a cheaper basis than if you were to use current hackneys, that the metered basis would be different. How much cheaper would the license be, and what sort of other incentives are you offering for people to try and do this?
Well, it would be low entry cost.
How low cost?
Well, the actual, I suppose, the cost of the license would be modest, around 50 euros. But the real issue is you wouldn't have to do a local area test. You wouldn't have to meet a number of other requirements that taxis have to meet, because you're only going to be operating in a local area. Also, as regards to charges, they would be agreed between the passenger or passengers and those who are operating the vehicle in advance. But I would expect that in many cases, it would be on a cost recovery basis. In other words, that it wouldn't really be for making profit, although a small profit is allowed under what we are proposing.
How soon?
We're looking at bringing it in before the end of the year. There's a number of provisions which are in the taxi bill, which is currently at second stage in the Dáil, which I am bringing through, which allows for a lot of flexibility in this area. So once that is concluded, we'll be in a position, hopefully before the end of the year, to bring this in. This is really about addressing a market failure in rural Ireland, a need for such transportation, and I think it'll be broadly welcomed by people.
Alan Kelly, just before we let you go, we were talking to John McGuinness from Fianna Fáil earlier, following on from a story in this morning's Irish Independent, and he was arguing that, in his view, there is a case to be made sometimes for the state, in other words taxpayers, to pay for wives or spouses to travel with ministers on trips abroad. Is he right?
I found his comments quite bizarre, to be honest. I don't know why he's trying to justify from his period as a minister. I'm not aware where it is, you know, seen as a necessary part of a trade trip for a partner or wife to travel. I'm also I'm not aware where the taxpayer should be paying. I don't believe the taxpayer should be paying for it, or indeed for St. Patrick's Day trips. It's not something I've been privy to or even considered. So I find his comments quite bizarre, to be honest.
Alan Kelly, thank you for speaking to us.
With no end in sight to the crisis in Syria, people in that country are facing an increasingly bloody and uncertain future, but also thousands, hundreds of thousands have fled to neighbouring countries such as Turkey, for example, and Lebanon and also Jordan are also facing very, very difficult conditions. A delegation from the aid agency UNICEF Ireland has just completed a visit to Lebanon, where they describe conditions for those who fled from Syria as distressing and dire. In recent weeks, tensions have also spilled over the border, with fears that Lebanon could be further dragged into the civil war in Syria. RT's Philip Bromwell travelled to the Lebanese-Syrian border, from where he sent us this report.
Tears and tension on the Lebanese border with Syria. This informal settlement in the northern Akkar region is just 2 kilometres from Syria. Around 50 people are surviving here in makeshift tents. There are hundreds upon hundreds of these squalid settlements scattered around Lebanon. Here there are no showers, no toilets, no cooking facilities. But today, for an hour at least, there is some excitement here. A delegation from UNICEF Ireland has arrived. Visits like this break the miserable monotony of camp life. they're also an opportunity to cry for help. Through a translator, the leader of the camp tells us that many of the children are suffering from diarrhea. They just don't have enough water here, he says.
We really don't care if it's contaminated, if it's not, we just need water.
A mother shows us her 8-month-old baby.
He has diarrhea, 10 days.
Who is clearly malnourished.
And he's not eating.
A father lifts the dirty t-shirt on another young child. We can see the baby's ribcage. Local UNICEF field workers say these children are among the worst cases they've seen since the conflict in Syria started more than 2 years ago. It's estimated Lebanon is now home to more than 1 million Syrians, a staggering amount for a country with a population of just over 4 million. Children are at the heart of the crisis. Many are psychologically affected by the terrible violence they witness. In this tent, a psychologist tells us about one of the children he's been counselling.
The case of a child who saw his mother, died, killed in front of him.
Was beheaded
due to a bomb.
But tragedies like this have become a daily reality in a conflict which has claimed more than 80,000 lives.
One child that are coming to us, I think it's...
One worker with a local NGO explains how his organization has been helping a young boy suspected of suffering the effects of nerve gas.
When the child arrived to our center, he had already all of the symptoms. So he was weak, he had weak nerves.
With horrors being heaped upon horrors, the UN has launched its largest ever appeal for humanitarian aid for the people of Syria.
How old is this little boy?
After visiting this settlement on the Lebanese border, the rugby player and UNICEF Ireland ambassador, Dunica O'Callaghan, reflected on what he had seen.
Been following the story all along, but it isn't until you actually see it. It is worse than I could ever imagine. They haven't got water, they haven't got food. There's kids in this very camp, there's kids dying from malnutrition, and that's probably the bit that rocked me. The bit that really shook me there was seeing two little girls the exact same age as my two daughters, but, you know, so from tiny little wrists, tiny, you can see their bones, it just, you think, if that's your kid, what would you do? And you would do anything. These people really badly need help.
That was UNICEF Ireland Ambassador Dunica O'Callaghan ending that report from Philip Bromwell. You can see more of Philip's reports on television news programmes throughout the week, starting just after we go off the air on Morning Edition. And Peter Power of UNICEF Ireland will also be talking about well, it's obviously a very distressing and escalating situation in Lebanon as a result of the war in Syria.
From today, you can have your say on Ireland's favourite new building. You've 33 to choose from in the People's Choice category. Last year's winner was the Engineering Building at NUI Galway. Michelle Fagan is here. She's President of the Royal Institute of the Architects of Ireland, who are organising the awards. Michelle, thank you for coming in to us. Full list and voting available on your website, www.riai.ie, or on Facebook. I won't ask you to name all 33. Some of the buildings that people might be familiar with already.
There are five schools on the list. There are I would actually encourage people to go and look themselves. There's a library. There are many great buildings. There's one in London even. We've got architects working abroad, doing some absolutely amazing work. And I suppose the most important thing for the Public Choice Awards, because it is the most important award of all of the RI awards, is the architects have had their say. The 100 entries have been brought down to the 33 shortlisted, and what we'd like to do is have the public come and look and engage with the process and to choose themselves, vote for themselves, because it is the most important thing.
What's the response been like from the public in recent years? Because you've been running this publicly for a number of years now.
Yeah, this is the sixth year, and last year voting has increased every single year. Last year was about 16,000 votes. We've had a very varying result as well. Last year was, as you say, NUI Engineering Building, but the year before was the milk market in Limerick, which was actually quite a small little project, really, but made a huge difference to the community. You know, it brought a great economic value to the markets there by just merely putting a roof over the market area, and it was an extremely popular project. And now it's on a kind of a tourist list. For visitors, you know, modern buildings do attract tourism, and they also attract, I suppose, the foreign direct investment. People are coming in looking for good environments for their people, so the buildings are extremely important.
Michelle, before we let you go, your profession has been one of probably the hardest hit by the mm-hmm. property crash. The long-running joke, and a bad one at that, was that there's no architects left in Ireland, they're all gone. How is the profession doing now?
Well, there are signs of increase. Last year, there's a small sign of increase, of increased activity. It was 16% up, and this year it's 32% up. So it's looking much better. There's a lot of work in the areas of building new houses and building extensions. That's most of the work. And then, of course, the government are rolling out an infrastructure programme for schools and for healthcare buildings. And they're going to be the awards of the future. So I hope that everybody in their communities are looking out for what's being built for the next awards.
Michelle Fagan, president of the RIAI. We'll have links on our website, and we'll tweet it as well on how you can vote for your favourite building. Thank you very much for coming into studio.